This is St. Pete X, affectionately known as SPX. SPX brings you St. Pete's brightest business people, civic leaders, and citizens who share their insight and expertise, as well as their love of our great city. SPX is presented by the St. Petersburg Group. Head to stpete.co to check out more episodes, and by St. Pete's most effective marketing agency, Big C. Browse to bigc.co to see their work. Now enjoy the conversation. Hey, this is Joe Hamilton, and I'm here with Nathan Schwagler. Welcome, sir.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And you are a co-founder at the Dolly Innovation Lab.
Guilty.
And how's that going over there?
We're busy, man. It's fun.
Yeah, cool. So one thing that I know that you've done and just recently that is super cool, and I've been just dying to hear the story, so I'm going to jump right into it. You took a little trip recently. You climbed a mountain, and you had some interesting company on that climb. Do you mind sharing whatever is not classified of that story?
Sure. So I think it's entirely possible that I've developed a time-consuming, expensive, and sort of non-Florida-friendly habit of high-altitude mountain climbing. I had the good fortune to be able to follow some research coming out of the University of South Florida. There's a researcher there named Dominic DiAgostino, and he and his wife, Dr. Sheila Ari, are sort of pushing the science in the area of nutritional ketosis. Most people in the world are operating off a carbohydrate-based diet, and your body's turning those carbs into glucose and using that as its fuel source. But it turns out you've got this secondary fuel system that your body can run on. It can burn fat. It can turn fat into, and I don't want to be careful about the science because that's certainly his wheelhouse and not mine, but it can turn fat and process it into amino acids, into ketone bodies, and your body can eat those ketones and use them as a fuel source. And Dominic's early research had led him down some really interesting paths with some really great sponsors like the Department of Defense and the Navy and NASA. And so people have taken an interest in his work. I started following his science, and we became friends through his wife, Chilla. And, at some point there became an opportunity. They were actually interested in starting a company, taking some of their science and commercializing it. They've got some patent positions, and the university actually owns the IP, but they're doing pretty successful actually at commercializing that stuff already. But Dominic and Chilla were interested in becoming a little bit more entrepreneurial and thinking about, how they might be able to play in both the business world and the scientific and technical world. So I brought them over to the greenhouse for 1 million cups, and I wanted to get them kind of plugged into the entrepreneurial ecosystem a little bit in St. Pete and the Tampa Bay region in general. Got them an attorney and, got them, a couple of the nuts and bolts pieces that you need to have. And while we were there, he said, "Hey, do you have any interest in climbing Mount Kilimanjaro?" I said, "Yeah, actually, I do." And he said, "Well, we've got this research mission coming up, and there are two of them that we're interested in doing, we've been asked to work on, but they're happening at the same time. And one of them requires us to be underwater, and the other one requires high altitude. And, they're both avid divers." And they said, "We're going to go do the underwater one. Would you like to do the high altitude one?" So I said, "Yeah, absolutely." And what this meant was sort of becoming familiar with their research, but then also with a suite of products. And you can refer to them as sort of exogenous ketones. So a synthetic formula of what your body can produce and turn into fuel, but instead in a powder, you just mix it in with water and consume it externally. Basically, it can get your body into the metabolic state of ketosis without having to adhere to that strict diet. And there were people in NASA and some other communities in the defense world who have been interested in this capability. So they asked me if I would go there, go up the mountain with some folks from the military community, and it would take a peek at and see in an informal research capacity, if there were any impacts from consuming these exogenous ketone bodies. So maybe 2 or 3 months ahead of time, I started consuming them myself, putting myself through all the research protocols and figuring out, how do you do this stuff in the dark? How do you do it when it's windy? How do you do it when it's cold? Right? And in addition to, making up little batches of this stuff to consume, you got to figure out, what does it do to people's taste? What does it do to their vision? What does it do to their strength? What does it do to dexterity, cognition, memory, imagination, things like that. So basically went up a mountain and took measurements along the way and sort of compiling all that data now and trying to figure out. Good research should give you more questions than answers, and I think that's what we're really trying to come up with. But I ended up being a very long walk up a very tall mountain, and very grateful for the opportunity to do that.
So When you consume the ketones, is the idea that given the choice, your body will take those over the glucose?
Yeah. So right now, your body's going to default to glucose. But if you can take, if you can trick it, so to speak, into ketosis through this synthetic stuff, then it'll burn that too. So you can get, you won't get the full benefits of being in ketosis, but you can get some of them. And that's where the science starts to get a little bit interesting, in that there's a lot of unknowns. We're not really sure, you know, how people's bodies react and, you know, what some of the upside or benefits of that could be.
Interesting. And you mentioned, I know there was some government employees that accompanied you. How did that fit into the picture?
Well, so the government's interested. There are scientific and technical groups around the world who are interested in what it would be like if, you know, right now we've got such a heavy influence. You know, most of what we're eating is just based off carbohydrates around the world. And I think there are significant dietary risks to having so much sugar. You know, we're consuming this stuff at an alarming rate. And the problem is that we're eating all this stuff and the downside outcomes don't happen. They're so far removed from consumption. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see as the science evolves over the next couple of years and decades. You know, do we wake up one day and realize that, hey, we've actually been sort of poisoning ourselves without even really knowing it? I know NPR did a piece a couple of years ago where they had discovered, I want to say in the 50s, some lobbyists had paid some researchers at Harvard to write a couple of articles that were pretty damning of fats, right, in your diet. And for a long time afterward, the food pyramid that we all grew up with sort of in our, you know, our books and on the walls at school, you know, all reflected that research, that line of thinking. Because now I think people are starting to wake up to the idea of, hey, actually your body kind of loves fat for a couple different reasons and it's used to consuming it. And, you know, we're going to bump up pretty quickly to the edge of my expertise in this arena. But at this point, you know, based off anecdotal evidence and kind of what I've been learning the last couple of months and doing this research, I think we might do ourselves a favor. We were able to strip out the sugar and, you know, be less scared of good fats.
Sure. I think it came out, I don't know, it's probably been known for a while, but it hit my radar that the guy that was instrumental in the food pyramid was a, whatever the position is in the government, but he was actually the former CEO of General Mills or something like that. And so the grains there was some coordinated interest there to make sure that we ate as many of those types of foods as we could.
Yeah, I think so. You're starting to align, you know, people who are responsible for providing guidance who also have commercial interests. You know, in a lot of ways, capitalism, I think, is the most compelling system the world has ever known in terms of being able to create value and create wealth. It doesn't always work well, and it gets blurry sometimes on the edges, and this might be one of those examples.
Sure. Self-interest doesn't turn off when you put on the government hat sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to, if we can, talk a little more about your companions on that trip, because, I think just saying government employees is a bit of an undersell, and I think that's kind of cool. And I'm really curious as to, you know, what your sort of camaraderie experience was like with them. So as much as you're, you know, able to talk about.
Well, I had the good fortune to be able to go with a team of people who were all U.S. Special Forces, so a team, you know, Green Beret designation and a mountaineering crew. And this was fun for me because, you know, I was able to train for this mission and put myself up against them physically. And I'd never spent, you know, close quarters time with people who had served in that kind of a role. So I learned quite a bit about military culture and just the brotherhood that comes along with that. I remember just being blown away by, you know, you think about these guys are spending all day, every day with each other in very close quarters. Sometimes they're in hotel rooms, sometimes they're in the bush, sometimes, you know, all sorts of situations, you know, whether they be relatively comfortable situations or, you know, situations of extreme risk and discomfort. And, you know, you and I are sleeping good at night because we don't have to do the jobs that they're doing. And I left that experience kind of blown away, both by the way that they've developed their own sort of language about how they relate with each other. And just every day they're building another layer upon layer upon layer of a bond that, you know, when they're kicking doors down and doing things that have a lot of question marks in terms of, we don't know what's on the other side of this door. And that's okay, because I know that whoever I'm running through this door with has my back. It's just a beautiful thing to see, right? Like in the business world, we don't really see that. In nonprofit arts and cultural institutions world, we don't really see that, right? Like it's just a different game. And those guys are operating at an extremely high level in the special forces, and they're really, really good at what they do. To get in there, everybody speaks at least two languages. They've all got specialty training. They're a dynamic team, and yeah, just a lot of fun to be around.
So a lot of that, obviously, there's a time element to that. They build up that bond over time, but another piece of that is sort of systemic, right? Because it's the nature of, in a lot of these situations, they have to absorb other people. So how did that impact your experience? Did you get at least a little bit of absorption into it? And then how did that change the process of climbing the mountain for you?
Yeah, it's a big difference. If you're a civilian, you stand out like a sore thumb when you're rolling with these guys. But at the same time, I think some of the principles that they adhere to show up even when they're with a mixed group. It was obvious to me that they always had an extra eye open for us, for the civilians who were on the mission, in the sense that no man left behind applies to everybody on the team. So I appreciated that. And they just got this extra sense of awareness. It's kind of a beautiful thing. Like, they're taking care of each other, but they've always got an eye out for their, for the team.
Cool. It's nice. So the actual walking up the mountain, how did that feel? How did the altitude affect you? And what were your major takeaways, emotionally from going through that, the physical exercise of that?
Yeah, like I said, I'd been training for this for a while. So I had the good fortune of doing some preparation through a local CrossFit gym here called CrossFit 9, and a lot of ex-military guys and some active guys still in there. So they took good care of me in terms of making sure I was in good physical shape. Spent a lot of time reading online, trying to get my head right so I could mentally be prepared for that stuff. Had good gear. There's a local shop in town, Bill Jackson's, that I was able to go and get outfitted up there. And then when it came time to actually climbing, started up a little bit low and slow. I think that's the way that the touring companies want to make sure that you can't climb that mountain without having some representation from a touring company. They regulate it to make sure that, it's a big business for them, and it's pretty much the only business for them. So Tanzania is an extremely poor country, beautiful country, happiness index is off the charts, amazing people, lovely, beautiful humans, and economically, they're just coming out of the agrarian economy, right? I mean, you're looking at subsistence farming is still probably the most popular thing. You get some mining going on there as well. But in terms of developing an economy, it's happened slower for them than some of the other economies in Africa. So tourism is a very important part of that, of their regional economy. And as a result, they make sure that tourists all have a great experience so that when people are reading reviews online later and they have a decision to make between doing the safari in, Kenya or climbing Kilimanjaro in Tanzania, that, I'm not turned off by anything that I read online. So they do a really nice job of that. And as a result, those tourist guides want to make sure that everybody has as positive of an experience as possible and has the best chance of summiting. So they're going to encourage you to go low and slow, but those special forces guys, good luck getting them to slow down, right? So they're kind of scrambling up the mountain. And I took it as a personal challenge, knowing that those guys were really on top of their game and they're really good at what they do. So I was able to just kind of test myself against their performance. Also knowing, I was curious too, because I had been in the state of ketosis for a while at this point. And, I'd been taking the supplements and pushing my body to the extreme. So I was curious what I was going to be capable of. And it turned out to be a really good experience. And those guys were an incredible benchmark to get to work against. There were times where I could keep up with them and then times where I settled back in the pack in the middle and sort of was on cruise control and trying to, make sure that I'd have enough energy to conduct the research at the end of the day and, and take good measurements and keep my head on straight. In terms of altitude, one of the rules that these guys abide by is that you want to hike up pretty high during the day and then camp down lower to get your body to acclimate. So you hike high, camp low. So we were able to do that pretty successfully, including on summit day, we actually were able to go up to, the summit on that thing is 19,341 feet. And then there's a glacier inside of a, you can come down maybe, 700 or 800 feet. And you're in a crater and there's a big, beautiful glacier there. And I remember being so blown away because at this point, I was pretty exhausted, mentally drained. The altitude has started to affect my brain a little bit. And, after a long day of climbing, after several long days of climbing, but including summit day, these guys went and everybody else is just beat. They start climbing this glacier. They put on their ice climbing gear and they're doing some additional testing. And, they've just got this extra gear. That's a beautiful thing to see.
That's cool. So speaking, I guess, of extra gears, then how do you come back? How does that affect your purview when you're back to the desk and the day job and the, you know, does that light the fire, build the hunger? I mean, I know it's not the only cool thing like that you've done in your life, but what's the transition back into, you know, the day-to-day administrative joys?
I'm not going to lie, it was tough to come back in the sense that I'd never been to the third world, so I hadn't spent too much time outside of a lot of the luxuries that we enjoy in our day-to-day. So I have just an expanded sense of sort of consideration, I guess, now. Worldview has been expanded, and I'm incredibly grateful for that opportunity. So I'm curious to spend more time in parts of the world that don't look and feel like beautiful, gorgeous St. Pete, right?
Right.
I think also it ignited more interest in high altitude climbing for me. So I'm looking at a couple other spots in the world now to take on some more. I'm in touch with some of those guys from the trip. And, you know, like I said, that interest is there from different corners of the government, military, and science communities. And people are really, really curious about, you know, should more people be on this kind of a diet? I think mass market too. I mean, every day online through social media now, I'm seeing more and more people that are moving in this direction in terms of their consumption patterns, being more aware, cutting out sugar, cutting out carbs, and you know, there's a cognitive benefit to it. There's an energy benefit to it in the sense that with carbs and being on sugar, you get these kind of crashes, these highs and lows in your day. Whereas in, you know, a state of ketosis, you've got an even keel amount of energy. And I found myself going through experiences where, you know, what I was comfortably doing an hour's worth of working out, maybe at the gym, I could do two. And then after two, it became three. And then I was like, holy crap, man. Like I could do four and I'm not getting tired. And I hadn't pushed my body to do something like that. You know, I was relatively, I've been reading books and writing papers for a long time, we'll say. 10 years worth of grad school and dad life. Hadn't been doing much physical work at all. So to be able to jump into this new arena and sort of take on physical challenges again brought something to life. And then I think also it's worth mentioning, you know, you talk about what did it do. I think personally, I don't know how this works for other people, but I'm at my best when I've got some crazy, ridiculous thing out in front of me. Or it's like, hey, plant a flag and then go get that thing.
Sure.
Without that, it's just so easy. The world offers you so many opportunities to be busy.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how many people get to the end of their life and realize, you're like, holy shit, I've just been really busy for a really long time and I didn't plant flags where I wanted them.
Yeah, I think it's an important part of drive. I know that sometimes if I feel a bit of malaise, I can almost always point to the fact that there's not a flag ahead of me that I'm going for. And it becomes, you know, sort of cross the finish line on a few things and having to do the support work, the grunt work to you know, keep those moving, but not having that. For a lot of people, it gets pushed in with vacations, and that's kind of the standard. I think everybody needs that, and then it's a matter of society builds in, okay, you're 2 weeks a year, or even the show you're going to watch on Friday night, because it's the show you watch every Friday night. You have those many versions of things to look forward to. So I think that's a base need that people fill. It's just doing a better job of making them more meaningful things, I think, at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely, right? So when you're a kid, you're like, you're like the next game or the next toy or the next thing, right? Like that's the flag, right?
Yeah.
And it's like my birthday or Christmas or whatever, right? I want to go play laser tag next weekend or something. And then you get a little bit older, maybe you're in high school and all of a sudden Friday night becomes like the thing, right? Like, oh, I wonder what everybody's doing on Friday night. Or like, I want to go out to this party on Friday night or something. Like that's the new flag, right? And then you get into college and, you know, who knows? I don't really remember what happens in college. But afterwards, you know, just to what extent I think we are being deliberate about our flags, flag placement, where we're putting them and why, right? And shifting, like you said, to be more sort of thoughtful about planting meaningful flags, even if it means there's a big distance between where I am now and where I'm putting that thing. Because I think there's always a way to get there, right? Usually more than one. It's just a matter of, you know, and here we're getting pretty close into goal setting, right? Like that's, you know, pretty well-established field. But I don't know, I'm a big proponent of that.
And I think it also, I see a difference in the nature of flags too, because I think they're what I would call ancillary flags, which are the things you do that you look forward to as for the experience. And then you kind of go back to your real life. And then there are the flags that are within the lanes of your core living. So to me, I mean, one of the things I was going to move into is you talk about some of the elements that you're experiencing now with this. A, you have this product, you have someone that you're helping build a business around this. You have the effect that it's had on your own body and in your own life. You've had an amazing experience, which then serves to reinforce that sort of loop. And so now, how do you make those flags ancillary flags, you know, things that you enjoy kind of on the side versus something, you know, as an entrepreneur, that to me now becomes a business and I'm all over that, right? And so how do you walk the line between making that flag sort of a hobby? Because there's a lot of cool stuff there going on that kind of have a, there's a triangulation effect, I think, that can make it something even bigger than that.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. It's crossed my mind. I mean, I've got a really, you know, great program happening over at the Dowling Museum, and we're really, really fortunate to be able to do the work that we do. And, you know, at the same time, you know, the world is full of opportunity. I think the biggest thing for me coming out of the University of South Florida's Center for Entrepreneurship program was I left that thing with a pair of glasses on, and those lenses are tinted towards opportunity, right? It's like, if you think enough about entrepreneurship, you realize everything in the world could be better, could be more interesting, it could be value add. We're just opportunities everywhere. You have a choosing problem more than anything else. And so that's where I'm at now is, you know, we've got such a great thing going over at Dali. Yeah. Choosing. Mm.
And then of course, then option three is not making it an either or if at all possible, but.
Correct. That's, yeah. But I mean, so that's choosing an and.
Sure.
Right.
Choosing and. Yeah. Because and then at some point you have to choose an or because you run out of ands. So.
Exactly. So right now, I mean, I don't know who, last couple of weeks, I've been seeing some stuff pop up online about diversification of identity, right? So if you are singularly sort of self-identifying in a particular area, domain of your life, like, you know, I'm a, you know, a writer, or I'm a finance guy, or I'm a doctor or whatever, right? Like the, you know, rate of change in the world right now is, and, you know, it's not slowing down, I don't think, without it, some kind of a cataclysmic experience or whatever, like it's not going to slow down. So that means by extension that there's an increased chance that your identity will, or the thing that you identify with the most, will experience some kind of disruption at some point. So if you aren't sort of diversified in the sense that I can identify or self-identify as participating in these different, go back to the flag metaphors, right? Like if I don't have diversity of my flags, mm-hmm. all of a sudden, if I'm singularly identifying with, you know, writer flag, and all of a sudden I get writer's block, I'm screwed. Mm. My world comes crashing down in a bad way. And it's an interesting mix because I think to be the best writer possible, immersion and sort of, you know, Rilke would suggest, hey, you know, if you can do anything other than write, then you shouldn't be a writer. Like only write if it's the thing that you can't help but do, right? So to be the best at that, you have to be sort of all of that, which then I think just exposes you or sort of increases the risk that that can come crashing down on you some way, someday, you know?
I think, yeah, part of that is, do you identify the thing that you are as the act or the process? You know, for me, I think of, I feel like an artist without any talent. And so I often refer to the businesses that I build as painting my masterpiece, because at the end of the day, it just happens to be my medium. I'm a business guy, but I could just as easily go do something else, but it's the process of self-expression that happens to come out through business. And so then you're looking at, you know, is it the act or is it the intention? But I noticed that a lot going back to the that specific identifier. It was strangely evident in the small town that I grew up in, Ohio, because people always at the base level, like they would collect one thing, right? So this is the person that liked pigs. And so for every, you know, every gift you got them, it was a pig this or a pig that. And, you know, on their gravestone, it was this person loved pigs, right? And it's just, and people identified with it. And if you cross somebody who was also collected pigs, then it's almost like their whole self-actualization was at risk and they wanted to compete with each other who was more into pigs, right? And, you know, there was the person in town who was the whatever person that loved this kind of music or loved this. I'm the Garth Brooks guy, right? Or girl or whatever. And so yeah, I saw that play out, that need to hold on to that. And they certainly didn't, you know, it was almost like it's hard enough to, I think that comes to the arbitrariness of it really plays into it because pigs are sort of arbitrary. And then you start to, because it's arbitrary, it becomes an exercise in maintenance of that pigness, right? Because it's not who you are, it's what you do. And so it becomes a struggle. And I think there's a general sadness that underlies it that you have to keep up this thing. You can't let down your pigness or else, you know, all of a sudden someone else might jump in or you might not feel that way. So it's, you know, it was almost like the reverse process of it. So, you know, they were reacting to the social feedback to their need for self-actualization as opposed to deriving it from inside. So I think to me, the first step in figuring out your flags is to, you know, try to make sure, sort of examine what of it is social and what of it is internally driven.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, right, the, I'm going to go back to the classic one-liner, right? The self-examined life isn't worth living, right? It's not worth living. If you don't know in your core that you're a pig man or pig woman, right? If you're unsure as to the level of your pigness, keep looking, right? I think I'd have a lot of students or former students when I was teaching at USF St. Pete, would say, you know, hey, prof, how do I know what I'm supposed to be doing? I'm about to graduate and I don't know what to do. I said, well, it's not a thinking problem. Like, it's not something you can think your way through. You can't cognitively try to work through whether or not you're supposed to be a pig person. And I feel like we're just going to run with this pig thing for a while now.
Why not?
But it's a thing that you bump your way into, right? Like, you don't think up a passion. It happens to you as a result of your lived experience. So going back to that diversification of identity, I think the way you get that is through diversification of experience, right? And I think if you are willing to go out and sort of discover the range of animals on the farm, you know, say, yeah, I come from a line of pig people. All right, that's a great start. But guess what? There are these things called chickens, or these things called cows, right? There are fruits and vegetables and planting and, you know, retail agriculture versus wholesale agriculture. And there's a way to, you know, and it's just, it's interesting when you challenge people to get outside of the lane that they come from, right? I think that gives people a chance. If you can help them, if you can nudge them towards diversification of their experience, I think people find their way. They bump their way into being successful. I mean, every once in a while you encounter somebody who just knows, right? Like, they woke up as a kid and they were like, I'm going to be a fireman. Mm-hmm. And they knew that when they were seven, and now they're the best damn fireman on the planet. And I'm all for that. Like, that's amazing. But it just happens for such a small segment of the population. The rest of us need to bump our way into that. And I love the bumpers in that sense, and in that people who aren't willing to accept sort of this middle ground of satisfaction with what they have, but instead they're going to keep planting flags that are increasingly further from where they are today, right? Like, my goal state is way out there, and I don't have to know exactly where it is, but I'm going to plant a flag in that direction and I'm going to bump my way towards it. And it's okay to have more than one out there too, right? So there are these two kind of schools of thought when it comes to goal setting. It's like, one, I need to specifically define the future success state, and then I will develop an action plan to get there. Another way to think about it is like, hey, there are these three areas that I'm kind of interested in becoming better at. One, fiscal responsibility, physical health for myself, physical wellness, and I want to learn more about 18th century Russian literature, whatever, right? Like, I'm not specifically picking a book. I'm not specifying a goal, body fat to muscle ratio, and I'm not specifically identifying, you know, an amount that I need to have in my bank account, right? But instead, I can commit to these three things, and I don't know which strategy works best for what kind of people or whatever, but I do know that it can happen. Both can be equally successful. It's just a matter of kind of what works for you, you know?
I think a lot of times most people run into the problem where they think it has to be the first one. They have to have the end goal in mind that's defined and how to get there. And if they can't have that, they get a little paralyzed.
I think if you're going to go plan B, if you're going to go, hey, here are the general themes that I want in my life and I want to increase my capacity or facility in these themes, it requires you to have a little more self-regulation. Because if you're not going to plant that very specific flag on the ground, then you got to be more willing to self-monitor and sort of hold yourself accountable along the way. I think, you know, for me personally, you talk about, so go back to that Kilimanjaro thing, right? There was a date for that trip. It was external to Nate. That was happening. Mm-hmm. You're either ready for that thing and you're ready to rock and roll or you're not, you know? So I enjoy that, right? So there's another one coming up that I'm, you know, it's significantly beyond my current capabilities, but I'm going to sign up for this thing and I'm going to do it. And just having that external, you know, if we're left to our own devices, like I said, it's easy to get busy and caught up in the day-to-day. But, you know, I don't know. Other than time, like, what do we really ever have, right? And you don't know how many heartbeats you're going to get. That's an unknown quantity, but we know it's fixed, right? So with that equation, you're kind of left with this question of, like, what do you want and what are you willing to give up for it?
Highest and best use of your heartbeats.
There you go. Yeah.
So when you talk about the lanes that people play in, and some of them are fixed and some of them are, like you said, take more monitoring, take a more robustness, and overlaying that onto corporations. One thing that that's always, you know, I've been curious to ask you about is how you talk about innovation to corporations, because, you know, even feeling pretty comfortable in that space, and we run into this too at the St. Petersburg group with how to engage with people, because there are sort of fixed rails that people run on, that corporations run on, where, you know, we buy paper and we buy toner and we hire accountants and things like that. And typically there aren't, you know, when you get the template for the budget off of online and plug it into your company, innovation and creativity are not on that list typically. So what's been your experience in engaging with companies and translating what you do, which is sort of fluid, to what they can put on their budget?
It took me a long time to figure this one out, and I still don't think I have it, just because every company is different in terms of what they buy and why and how. You got some standard things that I've learned to use as sort of beacons, but at the same time, I'll give you an example. I got trained in creative problem solving. I did an apprenticeship in applied creativity coming out of graduate school at SUNY Buffalo State. They've got this really wonderful program that operates out of a center called the International Center for Studies in Creativity. And you can learn the theoretical frameworks and the science behind individual and team-based creative problem solving. A couple different categories of people enter into this program, a couple different categories exit out, but one of them are referred to as facilitators or creative problem solving facilitators. And for me, that was the most high-leveraged, interesting work I was aware of back then. I remember I had a faculty member who looked at me and invited me to come work with him one day. And, you know, at some point, the budget for the thing showed up, and I realized his day rate was $4,000 a day. Mm. And I was like, I could probably actually pay down my student loans if I've made $4,000 a day. You know, I'm like, I'm used to making $9 an hour. Like, this is interesting, you know? I'm like, how do you do this? So started following him around. And I realized that basically, in a nutshell, what you're doing here is you're convening teams of people, smart people, to have interesting conversations about problems that matter to them or to their stakeholders, et cetera. Now, in a corporate context, this can take a couple different shapes and forms, but shortly after I finished this apprenticeship, the global economy crashes, right? So you hit the Great Recession, like in 07, 08, and all of a sudden, here's this, you know, Nate's floating around in the business world trying to sell creative problem solving workshops. And I can't even get my foot in the door, let alone have a conversation about a proposal, let alone sell in a project, et cetera. I'm just having the toughest time doing it. And, you know, I don't know, entirely too long afterward, maybe a year later, I changed up the pitch substantially, which really all that meant was, instead of selling creative problem solving workshops, I was selling cost saving strategy design workshops. Now, exact same tools, exact same framework, same facilitator, same everything. All we were doing is just using different words to describe the same thing. And at that point, and ever since then, I've done zero marketing and have never had to, right? It's all word of mouth, and it's like, hey, do you actually create value with these things or not?
So can you remember, obviously, it didn't just, you know, pivot 90 degrees in a day. What was that process? Obviously, towards the end of not seeing success with one way of presenting it, you tried it so many times, frustration grew. What was that transitional process? How did you come up with the second half of it from the first half?
Yeah, being broke is a great motivator. I think, you know, I was already a dad at this point, having the financial obligations and the responsibility and feeling that pressure. And, you know, I had the good fortune of spending time at the Center for Entrepreneurship at the University of South Florida and kind of going through that program. I learned a lot about business and learned the language of, you know, capitalism and economics. And, you know, it's tough to come from an applied creativity or like a psychology background and then sell into corporations. You got to know the language. Right. You got to be able to talk about value propositions. You got to be able to talk cost benefit analysis, ROI. Like, you got to understand the rules of the game if you want to win that game. So it took me a while to figure that stuff out. And then over time, you know, I didn't do it all by myself either. I worked for other consultancies and I worked for other firms who were selling this stuff as a service. So I became a subcontractor for them, and I'd fly around to different cities around the world or, you know, in these states and drop in, facilitate sessions, whether they be, you know, creative thinking workshops, ideation sessions, strategy sessions, trainings, retreats, that kind of stuff.
So did the work feel good then? Was it just getting past the hurdle, and once you were dropped in, then things ran well? Or did you also run into, did that not understand? Because obviously if you come in with this one thing, and I guess at that point, if you're coming in with the consulting agencies, they were probably selling it as cost savings.
Correct.
Or whatever. But
yeah.
So then I guess at that point, expectations were set and met, and it was probably good once you were in.
Yeah, most of the time. And every once in a while, if they've sold in something that you're not actually in a good place to deliver on, then there's going to be some friction there. And I've felt that before. There's been times where, you know, you get a firm, you know, based in a major market who's selling a high price point session, and you fly to that client, go do the thing. And, you know, there was a gap between what they were expecting, you know, what they were sold over the phone or and through the prep side. But really that stuff comes down to expectation management and sort of the code designing proposals that work for both sides. And hey, how are we going to measure this thing? How are we going to know we're being successful? All that kind of stuff. So, you know, fast forward 10, 12 years or whatever, now running this program at the Dalí Museum. And again, it's still difficult sometimes, I think, to sell creativity into corporations. There's a natural resistance to creativity inside of firms, and for good reason, right? Like, a business starts because it develops a business model, right? It develops a way to make money, and then it grows. It's like, hey, how can we preserve our money-making capability? Hopefully put a fence around it, protect it, but we're going to grow this thing, right? So all of a sudden, a new idea inside of a business or a new way to make money is a threat to the existing status quo. At one point or at some point, there's going to be a difficult conversation between the senior leadership in this firm of, do we deviate resources or move shift resources from the thing that currently makes us money to this new thing? If we do, we're putting the current thing at risk. Or there are going to be people who are upset about this. At the same time, this investment in the future might be the best long-term decision we can make for the business. And those are really difficult conversations organizationally from a structure perspective, from a politics perspective, from a budgeting and planning perspective. It requires an incredible amount of courage and alignment. Difficult conversations happen at all sorts of levels of an organization in order to make this work well. And I think that's why you see so many businesses that grow big and then die. They're unable to pivot. And at the same time, you know, we see activity in acquisitions happen for this reason, right? Mm-hmm. They're acquiring companies, startups that are, you know, potential competitors of theirs. I'm going to buy you instead, right? And not only can I keep my R&D costs down, but instead I can buy my competition. And I don't mind paying a premium for them. You know, it's like effectively outsourcing innovation. Now, at the same time, there's an argument to be made that, and I'm pretty sure a woman named Teresa Mobley out of Harvard has got some data around this, but I'm pretty sure that people who shoot ideas down inside of organizations get promoted faster than people who generate those creative ideas. And it's, at first, it might be a little counterintuitive, because you can say to yourself, wait a minute, people who are coming up with good ideas, creative ideas, are sort of not promoted as quickly as people who shoot them down. And it's, I think the thinking behind it is that people who can effectively kill an idea are perceived by others in the organization as being protectors. You know, they've got this sort of like paternalistic, like, you know, I de-risk conversations. But think about what this does in an organizational culture now. You're promoting the people who are the idea killers. So when you do need new ideas, when you do face a corporate existential kind of a threat, what capability do you have left to come up with new stuff if you've been promoting people who their primary skill set isn't shooting stuff down, you know?
I think it's also because they never fail. If their job is to shoot things down, then they never fail at that, right?
Yeah.
Whereas if your job is to try things, you sometimes fail. And so if you have a 0% fail rate, then you tend to get promoted.
Yeah, there's a good one-liner that comes from one of my favorite creativity researchers. Name's Gerard Puccio. And he says, with every idea, a person comes attached. And I love that, because by extension, every time you shoot down an idea, you're shooting down that person too. And if you're able to produce creative thinking on demand, meaning we can have new ideas, good ideas, anytime we need them, if you've got a track record of shooting down ideas and people, then you're screwed. Mm. When you do, when that startup does come gobbling up your market share, like if you buy into you know, Clayton Christensen's argument about the innovator's dilemma, and, you know, you start to see somebody from down market who gets some traction with a low fidelity version of a product that, you know, satisfies the same user job to be done or sort of customer job to be done that, you know, you're currently enjoying at a higher price point, they're going to keep moving up market as their capability grows. Right. And eventually your market share is going to be in decline.
And do you think there's sort of a complementary force that, I don't remember, the body at rest tends to stay at rest and the body in motion tends to stay at motion. I think that, you know, the status quo is there's only a segment of the company that has any motivation not to uphold the status quo too, because there's zero risk. If you're collecting a paycheck, then you're either going to collect that paycheck or you're at risk of not collecting that paycheck. So, you know, perhaps tying the tangible and intangible rewards to creativity is a critical first step in changing the mindset of the masses in a corporation.
Yeah, I think companies have their own center of gravity, and they certainly have their own momentum, right, in different directions happening. So anytime you're trying to, and we see this too in our line of work, where it's much easier for us to sell in a one-off kind of a workshop or a corporate retreat or an ideation session to solve a specific kind of a problem than it is to sell in a, hey, we should do a three-year-long organizational culture kind of a strategy, because the buy-in you need at all different levels of a large corporation to do something like that, it's just a lot harder to get those levers lined up.
Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, that starts at the top. So when you go in to do sessions, is it relatively clear to you pretty quickly whether this is a, you know, a check a box for HR or whether it's the true desire of leadership to make something happen?
Well, I think the litmus test is senior leadership showing up? Mm-hmm. Are they there participating too? And if so, are they there paying lip service to the thing, or are they there actually trying to sort of extract value from the process as well as contribute their own energy to it? So when I see companies that try to do change management stuff or, you know, change strategy and they do it well, they've got people who are bought in and people who are putting energy in at all different levels, understanding that it's going to create friction, you know?
So when you moved from, I guess, the creativity optics in the pitch to the cost savings and things like that, how did that influence what's the pricing process that you used? And I would assume that, you know, in the front end, you have to create perceived value and price accordingly. And then with this, you know, the second, when moving into the cost savings, then it becomes a little more tangible. There are actual numbers, and then you then have to price towards that savings. But of course, there's also some intangible value in addition to the savings that can be inferred. So how do you price something like that? And how did that change when you changed how you pitched it?
So the way that we describe the services that we provide now, or we refer to them as our different labs offerings. So the first category of labs offerings, we talk about them as solutions labs. So in a solutions lab, an organization, a client can come to us and say, here's a specific problem we're trying to solve. And through that conversation of me unpacking that problem with them, I can get a pretty good feel for what kind of a problem it is, how valuable it would be to them to solve this problem, how much energy they have to solve this problem, et cetera. And then what I think it would take to do it, who needs to be in the room, how many sessions is this going to take, that kind of a thing. So it's really a listening process. And then just leaning on experience, thinking about, you know, do we need to convene 15 Nobel level scientists for this thing? Okay, well, that's going to be pretty expensive to do, right? Or is this the kind of a thing that we can get your internal marketing, R&D, two people from finance who happen to be open-minded and have subject matter expertise in this arena, and then three people from the ops team? You know, can we convene them to get this thing done? And if so, how many days is that going to take? And then you're building it all based off of a cost-plus kind of a strategy from a pricing model perspective. Another way to think about it would be, you know, we have a second category of services. We call them skills labs. So in a skills lab, what the client really wants out of this thing is, and they usually come as previous clients of solutions labs. So they'll say, hey, that thing that we did that solved that problem that one time, we really liked it. Will you teach us how to do that? And at first I was a little bit reluctant because, hey, if we start teaching people our process, then they're not going to hire us anymore for the bread and butter, which is the solutions lab. But I quickly got over that when I realized that, you know, they really just wanted people in the organization to be more comfortable with the creative process. So you get a lot of people who don't think they're creative, right? In this part of the world, we've got this really bad habit of thinking or sort of associating creativity with the arts exclusively. So you're only creative if you're a poet or a painter or a musician or a choreographer or whatever. Whereas in other parts of the world, they think about creativity as problem solving. And that's a much more inclusive and open-ended definition. And I love that. I think everybody gets to be creative when we talk about creativity as being about problem solving, because we all solve problems every day, right? It's like, what do I wear today? How do I pack three lunches and get kids out on time? And, you know, we have big problems and little problems. But anyway, so, yeah, just getting people more comfortable with the concept of creativity and flexibility of thinking and being open-minded and generating new ideas, understanding that creativity is their job too. That's really what these companies were looking for with a lot of these skills labs, is teaching the tool set and the skill set of creative thinking. So with those, we can just charge a per cap flat class-based rate. So it's $300 a seat, or it's, you know, for a week, it's $1,000 or whatever that's going to be. Corporations are pretty comfortable and used to buying that. Like you said, they've got line items in their budget and they do this already. So that's an easier sell. I know who the buyer is. It's usually HR, and, you know, there's a lane for that. Whereas when you're talking about those solutions labs, man, that's a different ball game. You really need to find the problem owner who also happens to have the budget. And if they don't, then you need to help that person find people who do have budget, who can then get in on that proposal, right? So you're actually helping your buyer solve their buying problem before you can even solve the problem that they want to solve in the first place, right? So the third category of thing that we sell, we call them leader labs. So these are really just corporate offsite retreats that companies were already doing. They were already buying, and they're probably going to run them at a hotel conference room. When we started looking at the hygiene factors of what goes into running a successful corporate meeting, you know, you got to have sufficient tables and chairs, preferably everything has wheels, wall space to hang stuff up, AV, good food, parking near a hotel, in a hotel, near an airport, near public transit. You got these sort of just checklist factors that have to be there, right? And we started going down the list and saying, we can actually do these better. And not just a little bit better, we can do this quite a bit better. You know, if you think about the core business of a hotel, they're there to put heads in beds, right? Whereas if we were to specialize only on the meetings themselves, in addition to providing the infrastructure to have a good meeting, like most event spaces or like niche or boutique event spaces would, we can actually also provide the facilitators and then weave in these deliberate creative thinking tools and experiences that we do through the art at the Delhi Museum. Or if we go do these things at other museums or in other spaces, we bring the art with us, not the originals, but obviously we can bring comps. We can sort of provide a layer of meeting facilitation and value that you can't get anywhere else. And for us, that then became a differentiator that we could base pricing off of. So, you know, you're not paying anymore for the room and the tables and the chairs and the food, but you're paying for the outcome of the session, which we can make an argument is going to be exponentially better if you work with us than as if, you know, you just book through a hotel.
And I know you kind of ended up at cost plus, but I loved that you started with value. I'm a huge believer in value pricing. That's how we price everything at Big C. And it's the toughest way to price because it's hard to know enough about a business to know what it really means to them. But I think that your service is uniquely positioned to have potentially major impact on the bottom line of a company. The bigger company, the bigger the impact. You know, it could save them tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars with some of the changes that come forth from your, you know, from your efforts. And so is it possible to, you know, to tap into that? I think to some extent it can be. And yeah, so.
Yeah, especially when we try to shift people over, like once they've had an experience and we get them over in our subscription where they're sort of buying us regularly or sort of committing to annual amount and days of work, then now you're talking about value as opposed to, you know, it's like, well, my hours are worth this much. Right. You know, you're not trying to you know, squabble for that.
Yeah, I do not enjoy that. You mentioned a second ago about the way creativity is perceived in the States or the West or whatever and being tied to the arts. Do you have any, since you just live in this world, do you have any thoughts on why that is, why American culture does not look at the accountant or the more, you know, the more traditional non-arts professions and value creativity as a skill?
That's a cool question. I have no idea. I know in 76, a guy named Michael Curtin out of the UK developed an instrument. He calls it the Curtin Adaption Innovation Inventory, the KAI. And it's a psychometric tool, self-report kind of a survey thing. You fill it out and you get a score on a continuum. And he developed a line of thinking that there were two primary types of creativity. The first one is called adaptive creativity. And the second one is referred to as innovative creativity. And in the UK, that phrasing around innovative creativity means a little bit something different than what we would think about it here. But we'll start with adaptive creativity. On the adaptive end of the continuum, you've got people who their preferred method of introducing their creativity will be to make something incrementally better from within its current box. So it's an accountant who figures out how to do an accounting thing better. Okay? That's creative. I think we've got to honor that. We've got to acknowledge that. At the other end of the spectrum, you have people who are like borderline unemployable, like no job will be sufficiently novel for them. You give them a problem, they will probably are going to push back on your definition of the problem in the first place, right? They're not going to try to make the thing better from within the box. They're going to break that box. So I think one of the things we can do if we are going to accept the fact that this part of the world has a sort of limited definition of creativity is to just take it on a more individual level basis and think about people, everybody as being creative, as being part of a human, you know, it's a human condition and it's to create. Instead of asking the question, how creative are you? Just play with it a little bit and ask, how are you creative? So it's not a level question, how much creativity do you have? It's a style question. Mm-hmm. It's how is this creativity coming out of you? Does it come out of you as a painter? Great. Does it come out of you as a musician? Great. Does it come out of you as an accountant? Cool. Does it come out of you as an engineer? Sweet. right? Like, it's your ability. So take you, for example, right? It's like your creativity comes out in a couple different ways, but one of them is through creative deal making, right? Like, can you identify a couple interesting opportunities or assets that currently are sort of unrelated, or at least other people aren't seeing potential connections between them? Can you string these three things together and all of a sudden 1 + 1 + 1 = 12, mm-hmm. right? That's like the Joe Hamilton playbook, you know?
I like it.
That's incredibly creative. That's entrepreneurial creativity. You know, it's like, why do 10 people look at this thing and their pattern recognition mechanisms all see one thing, but then this one other person comes by and is like, actually, you know, mm-hmm. could be this other thing. And for me, I mean, that's just the coolest stuff in the world.
Yeah, sure. So a lot of it is understanding that we're already doing it. It's just attaching the appreciation of the label for it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's I think being more open-minded about the ways in which people prefer to create, understanding that people are going to have different preferences when it comes to that.
I think that it's getting better, I would say, pretty rapidly, along with all things, now that we share information as freely as we do with the internet. My gut would be to say that this, you know, creativity, like you said before, ideas are attached to people. And I think that a lot of times creativity was attached to eccentricity. And I think that in earlier days, America, 50s, 40s, 30s, 20s, that eccentricity was looked down on. And so I think that we're shaking off that stigma a little bit. And it feels a lot better now. I do think that you have, especially, again, a lot of it's just what is and getting insight into what is. And so now some of the people who are the most creative, we're getting insight into them, and they're getting, you know, like Steve Jobs, for example, who, or, you know, even some of our corporate leaders today are getting praised for that. And it feels better to me. I feel like we're moving in pretty rapidly in the right direction.
I think social's done an interesting thing here too. When you talk about, you know, daily now, we have this appetite for novelty. Like, it's, what's the newest thing? What's the shiniest thing? And I'm not suggesting that the newest thing we should sort of map that over to also having value. But at the same time, I think the appetite for differentiation in the marketplace is through the roof, mm-hmm. right? It's like—
Because the framework's there to support it.
Exactly. Yeah. We can now scan the world in real time for inspiration. And I just think you're going to start seeing this multiplying thing. It's already kicking in, right? Like, the internet can be this incredible thing. And I think, you know, I hope it gets there. Like, it's my dream. You know, I imagine a world in which people who have expertise and have great imagination can work together in a frictionless way to create solutions for the problems that matter most to us as a species, right? It's the great promise of connectivity. And I think as the tools continue to evolve, you know, around AR and VR, and I can transport myself to another place and sort of empathically understand a user problem in another part of the world and then deploy resources in my workstation here and then have solution, you know, printed in another place mm-hmm. in the world. Like, this is happening. Yeah. And I can't wait.
Yeah. And the connections are so powerful. You know, you have somebody who normally would have been by themselves. They're really into blue left-handed butterflies, and they would have been, you know, sort of stuck in their room alone with that. And now they can find 37 other people in the world that are into blue left-handed butterflies. And all of a sudden that becomes a thing. And you get all the benefits of the social sharing with that passion, and the bar keeps getting raised on the awesomeness level in that arena. And the appreciation is built in there too. So many things die on the vine because they simply don't have an audience. And now the people who do these things can find that audience amongst, you know, the whole world.
Yeah. Not only do the, you know, blue left-handed butterfly appreciators have a community to participate in, right? But then also the Joe Hamiltons of the world can combine and say, actually, there's 37 people who like blue left-handed butterflies. I
make a t-shirt.
Happen to, yes, I see there's an opportunity here. It's long tail
yeah.
reach, right? Yeah. I think in a lot of ways, the internet, we're still in the, you know, cat video phase.
Yep.
And that's okay. We'll get there.
I think the big challenge I see is, you know, there was kind of, the way things were built was that there was an overarching sort of mechanism that somebody decided the fashion, somebody decided this music was going on the radio, somebody decided one thing or another. And so there were some downsides to that, clearly, which we're correcting now. But there was some sort of organizational efficiencies with that. I don't know, maybe that's not the best way to express it. But I think, you know, what we're going to run into is how do we take the left-handed, you know, blue left-handed butterfly community over here. And I know you mentioned that there's entrepreneurial opportunity, but in what way does that play together to capture the efficiencies that come with mass involvement, right? Because I think that, you know, I think our brains are still not able to process that yet, because I think our abilities outpaced our social evolution in that regard. You know, a lot of that you see with how terribly a bad Yelp review hurts people's feelings, because really we grew up with, it was a big deal to get a message out there. You didn't have the internet, you didn't have review sites until 3 or 5 years ago, or, you know, to have that at the magnitude they have now. And so for someone to take the time to insult you, it was a huge thing, and to amass people. And so now it's just a flick of a button, and it could be nestled, you know, amongst a lot of other ones, but it still has that sort of overweighted impact, I think, on people, especially people that are over 40 for sure. And, but I think we're catching up to that, so then it'll become the norm where, because it's such a low barrier, people understand anonymity in a way that they never understood before, that they'll start to devalue and will have less, be less impactful, the negative Yelp review. And, you know, there's already the whole, you know, fake reviews, fake news, all that kind of stuff starting to push into the psyche. So, you know, once we make that adjustment and, you know, to the sort of mass sharing information, then I wonder what the next step is in then reorganizing those value systems to find what is important. And I think the fragmentation of people in a weird way makes that something that's hard for me to understand, because I grew up with that, you know, that homogenous sort of identity creation mechanism. I don't know, is that?
Well, I think so. In a lot of ways, I think it's a wetware problem, in the sense that a critical email from a coworker can elicit the same physiological response as what it would have meant to have been chased by a saber-toothed tiger 10,000 years ago across the plains. And the challenge is that those chemicals don't exit your body. I mean, that can take 30, 40 minutes for the cortisol and like the stress stuff to come out of you, right? Like a bad email can sort of really mess with your day from a sort of a cognition and physiological, how you're feeling on a chemical level. So I don't know how we will do it, but at some point, I think we're going to have to overcome our biological limitations, or not limitations, but our previous ways in which we've used our capabilities. We need to evolve to keep up with the tools that we're creating. Because right now, I think part of what we're seeing now is, we're not keeping up yet.
Well, I think that's the powder I want for my drink. So if you come across it, I'm going to pour some in, because I think that ties a lot into a lot of the global issues that we have. I think that we have a real gap. You know, I think United States and Western society was set up not well, but better than everybody else to handle the rapid come together and communication. But, you know, you look at a lot of the places that the internet has been brought to, they were generations behind, living in way more, we'll call it traditional. Just, you know, there's a clear path, social evolutionary path that societies go on, right? And they follow a lot of the same tracks. You know, if you look at Jared Diamond stuff, Guns, Germs, and Steel, and things like that, you can see that they move along the same track. And then all of a sudden, you come in and just give them this huge shot of adrenaline and of information, and they can't adapt to it. And, you know, we barely adapt to it. And, you know, we're still, obviously with the last presidential election, just crazy. All the rules are changing, right? And so that's affecting us as a pretty, you know, at the forefront of it, actually, some of the creators of it. And then you look at the places that get dragged from way behind us up. I think it blows people's minds. And I think that causes a lot of the stress and you know, desire to go, you know, to get more fundamental, or to get more, you know, just to find that sense of normalcy, or that truth that they can hold on to.
Yeah, it's interesting when you look at, I think Steven Pinker's got the data sets around this stuff, but he's always trying to make the argument that, like, hey, the world has never been better than it is right now. Headlines are flooded, like you get that old media line, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. Mm-hmm. And so it's like we can sell ads based off trauma and, you know, terrible headlines. We're going to get clicks. Clicks turns into eyeballs. Eyeballs are monetization opportunities. That's the game, right? We will figure out a way to take your attention and convert it into my money or our money. But at the same time, war is at an all-time low. Diseases are being eradicated, scientific evolution, and sort of we're doing some really awesome things. It's just, it's tricky. It's tricky. Taste making is sort of distributed now. And I think we're waking up to realize that, you know, gatekeepers may or may not belong there anymore. And all of a sudden, the tools to circumvent these traditional channels exist. And as a society and as a country, and, you know, what are we going to do about that? Is our system still the best system? Has it outlived its utility? I know it's a kind of a crazy conversation to have. And at the same time, I think the idea of democracy back when it first started, you know, we started to, 500, 600, 700 years ago, you start talking about these ideas. They were crazy ideas to discuss back then. So I don't know. I mean, there's a Berugin Institute that is a cool foundation which funds radical reimagination of what democracy means, or could you imagine a new way to structure You know, when you think about the idea of governance and the role that it plays in society, it's like build a government around blockchain, right? Like all of a sudden, if this transparency and accountability is built in to everything that we do, because right now it's an incredible gap there in our government systems right now. You know what I mean? So I don't know what the future looks like, but my assumption is that it's tech driven and we just have to make sure we don't blow ourselves up before we can get there to enjoy it.
Well, and the, the systems historically, can you think of a system that's existed that hasn't been top down? You know, I think this is potentially the first bottom up system, which is, I think that it's awesome, also scary in the fact that the most resourcefully manipulative people will be the ones that can grab the, grab the land, the good real estate in that system. But, even the newest systems of all were all top down. There was a group of people getting together saying, this is what it's going to be. And everybody else goes, okay, we'll follow along. Right. And now it's being built in real time by little pockets of, butterfly and people.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see when you start giving people choice, right? So right now it's pretty difficult to make a choice to move somewhere else that has a very different governance structure. But once we figure out how to live on water, right, to get it out in international waters, I just saw something on the internet the other day that I thought was kind of a cool idea. Scientists getting together who feel like the confines of the research community are, it's really difficult to do the research that they really want to do. So they're going to do it in international waters. If you can build labs on the ocean, now all of a sudden you can, discover what you think needs to be discovered as fast as humanly possible. I don't know, fast forward another 100 years after that, maybe, the idea of a multiplanetary species really is realized, right? And, the moon base is where I go to live with my fellow pig people or my fellow left-handed blue butterflyers, you know what I mean? Or, when you look at Mars, which kind of in a funny way takes us back to the original conversation we had about Kilimanjaro, there are people within NASA who feel like, the first astronauts that we send to Mars should be on a carbohydrate-based diet versus people who think that, hey, it should be on a ketogenic diet. And there are different implications for this. It's like, we know we can grow potatoes on Mars, astrobiology, we've got a pretty good idea of what we can do there. But at the same time, we also know that your muscles atrophy when you're in space, and there's downside risk to being on this carbohydrate-based diet compared to some of the protective effects that you might see if you're on a ketogenic-based diet. So yeah, I don't know. We'll see.
All right. Well, we'll pick that up next conversation.
Nice.
So I've enjoyed our time. I like to end each conversation with a shout out to someone cool. You were deep in the soul of St. Petersburg, and you've seen a lot. And so I'm asking with great anticipation to hear who you would like to give some attention to in St. Petersburg doing good stuff.
So I think I got to tip my hat to a young man who's doing incredible work in the community. He's busting his butt, really trying to help sing the song of St. Pete. And that's Thomas Paderek. And Thomas, with his partner, run a branding and a creative agency called Stevie and Fern. He's very active in the Surf Rider Foundation, helping to keep our beaches clean, leading the charge to ban the plastic bag in St. Pete. And just incredibly active, highly thoughtful, creative guy, and boundless energy. I think more like Thomas would be good.
Brilliant.
Check him out.
Cool. And as always, all that information, everything we've talked about today will be in the show notes. So links and pull out quotes and insights and all that good stuff. And you can check those out at stpete.co, stpete.co. And thank you again, Mr. Schweigler. It's always was good spending time with you.
Thanks, Joe.
You've made it to the end of another great episode. For show notes, head to stpete.co to the show notes page, which includes links to all the resources mentioned in the show, as well as quotes and key insights from the show and information about the guest and the host. Thanks again to our sponsor, Big C. Head to Big C, that's BIGSEA.co, to check out their work. And if you like what you heard, make sure to share this episode on social media and leave a comment. See you next time.